My name is Gary Butterfield, he, him.
My name is William Hughes, he, him.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs. It is a Games Club podcast. And this episode, we are talking about Split Fiction, an action-adventure game from Hazelight Studios, released on modern platforms in 2025. And as you're hearing, instead of being joined by my good friend and podcasting partner, Kay, I am joined by my good friend and podcasting partner, Will.
Inferior podcasting partner, but yeah. You do more shows with Kay, and don't think I don't keep track.
Yeah, I do more, but I do better ones as well.
Yeah, no, it's all around. Your output with Kay defines your whole career. It pays for your house. Your output with me, you literally, I think, lose money on.
I do lose money on it. it's what we call a loss leader.
But it also is way less listened to. It's really a loss follower.
It is a loss follower.
I'm a blight on the network is my point.
Me when I'm looking at webcomics. So this episode's a little special. We're doing guest episodes this year, so Kay and I can take vacations. We talked about this in the dispatch at the beginning of the year. If you're not familiar, Kay has done an episode with Ben, and I did an episode with Brayton. Kay is doing an episode with Bob Mackey again in the future. And we're doing this episode here, and these episodes with guests are going to be a little bit different. A little bit less play-by-play and a little bit more zoomed out. But I needed to talk about Split Fiction. And Will has played it. And I thought it'd be a great opportunity to get Will on. Will, how might people know you other than Guppy?
Yeah, I want to start by saying, you say the thing about the vacation. You did just force Kay to come do tech support for us for this call. Yeah. And she said she's just sitting around the house all day. So I don't know.
She literally said doing nothing. Right. I'm just hanging around doing nothing.
Yeah. So yeah. I don't know if you're really maximizing the vacation aspect of things.
Well, maybe Kay took a vacation when she would have been playing Split Fiction.
Ooh. Or maybe, is there a word for a vacation where you stay at home?
I think it's a vacay stay.
I call it a staincation because of what happens to my sheets.
Because it's been
sweaty.
A while. Yeah. How do people know you?
Yeah. Sorry. Thank you, Gary, for keeping me on track. So in addition to being half of Everything to Guppy here on the Duckfeed Network, I am also a staff writer at the AV Club, where I am roughly in charge of our video games coverage. I do a weekly column called Game Theory that is basically whatever I've been playing that week. I try to find something to say about it, even if it's just praising the banana in Donkey Kong Bonanza. Mm-hmm. And also just generally I write for the site. I write news, I write TV reviews, I pour
obits.
My brain. What, Gary?
Obits.
Oh, I do write obituaries for people that die on Saturdays. If you die on a Saturday and you're famous enough, I'll probably write about your death and your life.
It's kind of like a Russian roulette. You know, 1 in 7 chance, roughly.
Yeah. If you die at night, I have a decent chance of being the person who writes it.
Yeah. So listen up, Christopher Lloyd.
Now, Gary, why did you do that to Christopher Lloyd? Why did you kill Christopher Lloyd with your words?
I just think he seems next. I love him, but he seems next.
Gary, can I be honest? I have a pre-banked obit for Tim Curry that I wrote, I think, 6 years ago, and the man just holds on. I mean, God bless him.
Yeah, yeah. You had to keep updating it with like new feats and sexual conquests and stuff.
I don't actually, because he doesn't do anything. He just keeps living.
Yeah. Good for him.
Oh. Good for him. I don't want Tim Curry to die, but it would.
I don't want him to either.
I'm ready for it, though. I'm ready for it. Readier for it than anybody on this earth except Tim Curry.
Yeah. And Tim might be a little bit more ready for it, honestly,
yeah,
at this point. The reason why I wanted to get you on this is because Everything to Guppy is a very stupid show.
It is.
I'm very proud of it, but it's very dumb. And you are a good games thinker. I like how you write about games. You're one of the only games writers I read basically everything you write. And I like it. And I wanted an opportunity to get what I affectionately call Smart Will on the show. Even though I think Everything to Guppy is kind of almost smart sometimes.
Almost smart sometimes. But I, as a rule, I pour the entirety of my intellect into my job, even if it doesn't always seem like it when you read the things I write. Mm-hmm. So I usually try not to think too hard when I'm recording a podcast. But I think Split Fiction is a really interesting game. I reviewed it for the site with the help of our features editor, Jen Lennon, who played through the game with me before it came out. I think it is, like all of Hazelight's stuff, really interesting, and kind of the flaws are built into what is great about it to some extent. And yeah.
And they're loud. Like, part of the reason why I really wanted to talk about this game is that it puts me in a weird position where there are so many things I think are really cool about this. I really like it. The things I don't like about it are incredible. Like, incredible in terms of hugeness. You can see them from space.
Yeah, if any other studio was doing what Hazelight did, Hazelight would be the second best at the world in the world at doing it.
Yes. It is really the only game in town for a certain kind of thing that allow, and I want to say, this allows them to neglect this narrative writing aspect of what they do. They care about it so fucking much.
They do. They're just not any good at it.
It's awful. So this game sold really well, you know, so it doesn't, I don't feel like I'm punching down here. Got really glowing reviews here. The studio, Hazelight, founded by famous curse word user Yosef Ferris, who directed a movie called Balls. I just found out about that.
That's exciting. I don't know about Balls, Gary. I haven't clicked this Wikipedia link in the notes. What's Balls about?
It does not say. It's a Swedish film. And you get to see the cover. You kind of get a vibe from the cover, but you do not get to know what it's about.
I'm hovering over a Google search for Balls Yosef Ferris, and it's such a risky tap of the enter button.
Delicious fruit from a poison tree right there. Before he made Hazelight, this guy got famous for making Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons for Starbreeze. This was the first episode of Check It Out, Comrade. Mm-hmm. Have you played that?
I have not.
It is a proto-Hazelight game, except instead of it being, it's a single-player co-op game is kind of the way that they sell it. You control each brother with a different analog stick and kind of use them to solve puzzles and everything. It's much like, you could see some of their pet obsessions.
Yeah, only thing I know about it is the trick it pulls at the end, which does sound very clever.
Yeah, and that's kind of a Hazelight thing too. Like there oftentimes is a trick at the end, which is pretty good.
I mean, we don't have to be oblique. I can say what the trick is because it touches on their themes. So you spend the whole game with one button to control, like to interact with one brother, and then the other button to interact with the other brother. The older brother dies, and at the end, the way the younger brother empowers himself is by, you can suddenly use both buttons to like have his older brother's spirit help him go forward.
Yeah. It's like Ornstein and Smough.
Yeah.
You absorb the brother.
It's the first Dark Souls reference of the episode, but not the last.
Not last. After that, they have their niche, which is co-op mandatory games. I've when sitting down to talk about this episode and think about it, I was surprised to find I have played and enjoyed all of these games. Mm-hmm. With asterisks. A Way Out was a Watch Out for Fireballs episode. You can hear Kay and I talk about that. A game about two men who act less like humans than anybody in the world escaping from prison. That also has a cool twist at the end. You turn against each other. It's a co-op game until the entire thing, and then you have a shootout at the end. And then It Takes Two, which is the joking name of it is a divorce simulator. Mm-hmm. I found a YouTube of Yosef Ferris being asked that question, or he was responding to comments on the Split Fiction preview. And somebody said, oh, great, another divorce simulator. And he seemed confused by that.
Was he enthusiastically angry as well?
No, and he's actually in pretty good mood in this one. It's rare because he's an angry guy. Not angry, but like
enthusiastic. Like, if people don't know, Farrah's got kind of famous because at the Game Awards, TM, copyright Jeff Keighley, he would get up and do these interviews where he would just start like screaming fuck and stuff in the middle of like this, like the Jeff Keighley's attempt to make the Oscars would just have this kind of rabid, hairy man screaming, I'm so fucking happy to be here.
Yeah. He's very enthusiastic, very, very passionate. As a man. And credit to him, he did respond. Somebody was like, oh, this is more feminist propaganda. And he had the good response to that, which is like, what? Because it has two girls in it? Like, A Way Out was two guys. What are you talking about? Which is the perfect reaction to that. Stupid. That game is very similar to this in how it plays, I would say. So much so that I feel like mechanics and puzzles are kind of lifted straight from it. But with a different, kind of slightly different, you know, conceit, and then a different narrative framing, that one being two people who, have no reason to be together, trying to stay together for the sake of a kid.
I played A Way Out. I think A Way Out is really interesting. I did not play It Takes Two because I would either have to play it with my best friend or my wife. And either one seemed like a weird game to play through a divorce game about with.
If you could tank the writing in this game, you could tank the writing in that one.
Okay.
If you add, it's like this one, but with the addition of an extremely racist book, like an anthropomorphic book that is about relationship advice, who comes in and it has like a straight up, like, I don't want to do the accent. It's a racial characterization accent that pops up. It's
weird, like a Latin lover voice, right?
It's a Latin lover voice, but it's real big.
It's like a Hank Azaria Latin lover voice.
Yes. That's a good way to put it. As a child of divorce, a divorce that needed to happen, that bothered me, you know, and as a child and participant of divorce, I'm a pretty big believer in divorce. Them doing this, you know, big quest to not get divorced always felt silly to me. And then they came out with Split Fiction. A lot of the things studios do will kind of come out as we're talking about the specificities of them. But Split Fiction is kind of an apotheosis of all of their themes, all of their foibles all at once.
I'll say up at top, I think this is, it's certainly their most polished game. And I think it's probably, from what I've played and seen, probably their best game. They are becoming more confident in doing the things they are good at, even as they are very comfortable staying bad at the things they are bad at.
It's really similar to It Takes Two.
Yeah, that definitely tracks.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's probably slightly neater, but the gulf between this and A Way Out is huge. This just feels like a short iterative step from It Takes Two to me. How would you describe Hazelight's trick, their thing?
I mean, the most simple version of it is it's fun to do things with your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. Co-op is inherently, every game I've ever played co-op, I've liked at least 10% more than I would have liked otherwise, because it's a shared experience that I'm doing with a friend.
Yeah, and it's worth, like, thinking about a little bit, like, what it actually does. It's not just a shared experience with a friend because you have warm friend feelings and stuff, but from play, you get to do things with your friend in a game space that you can't usually do. Like, you can make each other laugh. Like, you can do things that are funny. You know, when Derek and I will play co-op games, a lot of times they'll be in the shooter engine and we always, you know, let's see crouch hopping and moving backwards crouching and see how weird this fucking looks. You know, little things you can do, or like a very serious cutscene will happen and you can have your character doing something very silly. You kind of are socializing at the same time, not just through the mechanics of the game, but also just because you're controlling a little avatar that your friend's watching and it's fun to make your friend laugh. You know?
There's also an aspect like that. These games are built around actual cooperation, not just let's both shoot the same guy, but they create actual situations where you have to communicate, where often one person is responsible for the safety of another.
Yes.
And those do generate like real actual feelings like, oh, like there's a moment late in this game that genuinely moves me where one of the characters is overwhelmed by despair. And the other character steps up and just protects her.
Yeah.
And that's a, like, I get real feelings out of that. It's, and you can't do that in single player. You can only do that through this cooperative collaboration that they force you into.
You can't do it in single player, and it's harder to do outside of games. You know, doing it a game, you're actually doing it. You know, whereas seeing a character do that in a passive medium is not as strong. You know?
And that character's not my friend. That character is, like, you know, yes, Zoe and Mio in this game are protecting each other, but I'm also protecting my fellow players.
Exactly. Yeah. For me, I didn't feel a thing in this game. I wish that, sure, I could have, like, other than fun. But their downfalls, their writing and their world building and character work, performances, all that stuff keeps me at too long of a distance. Mm-hmm. So part of my frustration with this company is that I can see, like, a hazy mirage what you're talking about. Like, if I ever felt like I was protecting or helping my friend Derek, I would feel something.
Do you think, you know, that maybe they should add in technology to put Derek's head on the characters?
They should put Derek's head on both characters.
I think so too. Like, and again, not a camera system where whoever your partner is,
no,
is put into the game. Derek.
Split Derek. Yeah. Ooh. The just the tale of two Derek's.
I do.
Brothers, a tale of two Derek's. It takes two Derek's, split Derek's, and away into Derek. They do these things, and just kind of thinking of it, so they has that trick, the co-op stuff. They design around it. One of the things I like about how they design around it is it's hard to quarterback this game.
Yes.
If you're not familiar with that term in co-op gaming, quarterbacking is when somebody just tells the other person what to do during it. Because you're both being exposed to new situations constantly, and because you don't know what role you're going to get before you get it, mm-hmm, you can be thrust into the role where it'd be more natural to quarterback or receive instruction kind of at random. So I feel like this has a democratizing effect as well, you know, when you're actually trying to work together. Like, you have to actually work together. It's not like, you know, like, I've had situations where I played, like, the first time I played Doom with somebody else, mm-hmm, you know, I had not played the map they had done. I was pretty young, you know, it was early. And they just told me where to go the whole time.
Sure.
And it was still really fun. It was still fun. Like, you know, I had fun. It was co-op Doom, right? And there's kind of like a fun little role play aspect to that. But it was also, I don't know, it wasn't as give and take.
Or like where I play Balatro with my wife and tell her every single card to select and which jokers to buy because I love her.
Yeah, that's a quarterbacking thing. This game does not want you to do that.
Oh, I thought I was doing the good thing.
Did not say whether quarterbacking was good or bad.
Gary, do I need to play It Takes Two with my wife?
I would be really curious if you did, especially if you were like, oh, it fucking devastated me. I cried the entire time. Like, yeah, if this was the key, like, this brought you and your wife so close.
Hey, bud, I need somewhere to stay tonight.
Yeah. Like, 'cause you still got that pullout couch. What's the matter? Oh, I played It Takes Two. What? The one with the book? Yeah. I love him so much. Be incredible. But I like how these are designed co-op. It's not for one player to master and have experience in it. Like, theoretically, you could go into it having played it already. Mm-hmm. You want to play it again and you know all the things. You could guide somebody through it. But on a first-time experience, you're on really even footing, which I really liked. Like, it was fun to try to figure out what it wanted. And it was fun because we had literal different perspectives. So we could, yeah, see things the other person didn't. It required communication in a way that co-op does not always require.
Yeah, well, touching on that, the game often goes out of its way to make the experience you're having asymmetric with your partners.
Yes.
In most of its scenarios, you have a different power set. Now, I can have some quibbles with how interesting some of those power sets end up being.
Yes.
But overall, you are generally not doing the exact same thing at least half of the time.
I would say a lot more than that. They do a pretty good job of that. You know, sometimes the difference is really minor. It's just like what force field you can shoot, you know, what color doodad you interact with. But a lot of times you do have at least slightly different verbs.
You also mentioned the perspective thing, and I think that's something that's interesting to talk to for a second.
Yes.
It's an interesting decision that at every point in this game, both players are given the same screen. You can play this couch co-op, but I think most people are probably playing it online. Would be my, mm-hmm, I don't know. I guess maybe that's a weird assumption to make.
They treat it the same way either way.
Yes, so. You are always getting the exact same. Both players get the exact same screen, and I'm of mixed feelings on this.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the tricks that the game is playing with perspective wouldn't work if the players were seeing different stuff, but it's also something where there's some like really cool stuff they could do. Have you covered the Dark Pictures anthology games on here at all?
We have. Or no, actually not the anthology games. We've just done the real ones. I always get those confused with the real ones.
Yeah, the Dark Pictures games specifically are meant to be played online if you're doing them in co-op mode, and they actually give you the other character's perspective. You see things that that your partner doesn't see, which is crazy in like the games with like ghosts in them and stuff, where like literally one person is seeing a hallucination and the other player isn't.
That's super neat.
Split Fiction doesn't choose to do that, and it's deliberate. It's a very intentional choice. But I was a little put off by it at certain points because I think we're going to talk a lot about how the characters in this game don't work.
Yes,
and I've played through this game all the way through as one character, and about halfway through as the other. And at no point during either of those playthroughs did I identify with my character.
In part because you're always seeing both characters at all time and keeping an eye on it.
Yeah,
that's in service to the final trick.
Yeah,
that it does. I think that if they just switched to this view in the end, it wouldn't work. It would be too disorienting.
Mm-hmm.
It's already fairly disorienting when it happens, but I think they need to train you to kind of keep an eye on both characters.
Yeah, they get something for not doing this, absolutely. Yes. But it is a very deliberate design choice that you have to make when you're making a cooperative game. Marrying the both players' viewpoints together, or are we giving each one an individual viewpoint?
Yeah. And the individual viewpoint thing happens a lot in games that have a split fiction section in them. Mm-hmm. You know, we just covered Resident Evil 6 not too long ago, and that works for that. You know, one character is on one side of the map, they're covering you with a sniper rifle, you get to go into in and out of buildings and you see what the other person doesn't. You know, that kind of stuff happens in like Fear. That happens in a lot of co-op games. Typically, though, it's not the whole focus of the game, you know,
yeah.
And it's very rarely used artfully. It's almost always, you know, here is a game where that could be used artfully, since ostensibly we're kind of doing Psychonauts shit in this, where you're exploring spaces created out of your character's subconscious and memories and everything. That's really rich. The idea of me being in your head and not seeing things the same way you do.
Mm-hmm.
Is a cool idea, you know,
which is that is one of the tricks they pull right at the end of the game. But because you have most of the game is in split screen, it's very easy to see, oh, both sides of like, we're looking at the same thing with a different filter over it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This is, as we mentioned, we're going to talk a lot about the characters and all of that stuff works. These are like the worst narratives I've ever seen. In games, I think I hate this narrative. I really have a lot of problems with it. It's funny at points because it's not entirely unenjoyable because sometimes somebody will say something, but it's excruciating. We're going to get into that a little bit more as well.
It's irritating both on an emotional level and on like an overall plot level, I think.
Yes. Like, yeah. And from a performance level as well. I don't like the performances in this game. Worth really, you know, quickly kind of going over aesthetics because I don't feel like they're that noteworthy. This was developed in Unreal. I think it looks like an Unreal game.
Yeah.
The soundtrack is fine. You know, to me, it's nothing super special. The thing that I think aesthetically that is the big failure, if you're not considering writing and dialogue aesthetics, is anonymity of art design.
Yes.
In this. This hurts the game a lot to me. The idea of there being this dichotomy between fantasy and sci-fi, and then just choosing the absolute most stock boilerplate versions of both almost every time really hurts it to me.
Yeah.
There is no sense of artistry in these sci-fi spaces and very little sense of artistry in these fantasy spaces in a way that sucks.
Like notably, one of the reasons that the game is basically split between main chapters and side stories. The side stories are almost always better, at least in part, because they have some kind of visual flair to them.
Well, and often a mechanical player, and they last less long, and your characters aren't talking about their traumas as much.
Yeah. The one place where I'll talk about the look of the game that I think it does work is in playing with those perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
I think the camera work in this game, when the game takes the camera away from you from just your basic split screen, is often really inventive and cool. There is a moment, I've played through the first half of this game twice. There's a moment early on in the first big chapter where you know they're flexing with how they've made the camera like pull out as one character is running on top of something while the other character is running along the side of it. Then I'm like, this looks kick-ass.
Yeah. Yeah, there's neat stuff done in, when I was saying art design, I specifically mean like the assets.
Yeah, the assets are like, terrible. The assets, like the levels and the things, uniformly are terrible.
Yeah, there's definitely some artistry in the camera, 100%. That's pretty neat. And artistry, like both in terms of impressive things that kind of fit with the gimmick of the game, but also just like nice, you know, high quality, good camera work.
Yeah.
You know, that happens. Like that looks good. I wish I was looking at something that looked better.
Yeah, you know, the inability to give this whole game is about a split between sci-fi and fantasy, and the inability to give each of those a really distinctive visual flavor most of the time is a huge detriment to the whole fantasy of the whole game of like, oh, we've got these sci-fi elements clashing with the fantasy elements, but they don't because they both kind of look like Unreal slop.
They look like Unreal slop, and every sci-fi thing looks the same as every other sci-fi thing.
It does. Ostensibly, you're going through different stories. You could show me a screenshot, and if I wasn't looking really closely at the costumes they're in, I could not tell you which of Mio's stories you're in.
Yeah. Are they Iron Man or are they not Iron Man? Because there's a period once where they have Iron Man suits.
Mega Man-styled Iron Man suits.
It's true. Yeah. I hate it. I hate the way all this stuff looks. We're going to get into that split between science fiction and fantasy, which I hate as well. I think that is a child's idea. And it's weird that it's taken seriously by all the adults in this game. Anonymity is a big thing. We're going to get into the specific blandness of those designs. But first, we are going to recap the plot here, even though this isn't a traditional Watch Out for Fireballs episode. And I just pulled this from Wikipedia. I played this for disclosure, getting my hands on the table. I only played this once. I finished it probably about a month ago with my friend Derek. It feels very anonymous to me. I could give you a ballpark of it, but I would miss individual story beats, largely because they're stupid and my brain rejects them.
Sure.
I just like, oh, that can't be it. Oh, it is it. So we're going to go through this. We're not going to just read this Wikipedia, but we are going to kind of go through the plot. So if you're listening to this as a service, you just want to know what happens in split fiction, so it'll make sense when I'm talking shit about it later. This is what happens.
Okay. I'm excited. I'm going to sit and listen. Do I have to talk during this part?
If I get tired, I'll let you know. We have two characters, Mio and Zoe. They're invited by a company called Raider Publishing because they have an experimental device that they're going to use to they're told they're going to be published, but they actually are going to be put in an experimental device.
Can I do a little ding sound effect every time I roll my eyes?
Are you rolling your eyes at me?
No, Gary, come on. This is,
I know. I'm just joking. That's the reaction I wanted from that.
I'm on your side today.
It's awesome. I feel
really
so powerful.
Uncomfortable, actually. I don't like it.
You can certainly do a little ding.
The man who's trying to steal all of human creativity to make his big machine is named Raider.
Yeah, he raids. J.D. Raider.
Literally, the first eye roll of the game was on the title screen, which shows the Raider.
The logo.
In this
skyscraper, this publishing complex.
Does he actually publish things, though, is my big question.
It's extremely unclear what actually happens with this guy. So Raider is going to do this. This is the first time I've seen his name as well, because he just calls himself Raider and everyone's called Raider. Yeah. But he does it to himself as well. He comes in and he introduces the machine. The idea is people go in these matrix bubbles and they experience their stories as reality. The stories they submitted. You know, okay. And everyone says, cool, man, put me in a suit. Put me in the machine. Seems good. While this is happening, they're in suspended animation. Mio is a little suspicious, though, tries to back out and ends up getting stuck in the same bubble as Zoe.
Yeah, she gets like, she's like running around like flailing and panicking and gets pushed into the bubble. And uh-oh, people aren't supposed to go into the same bubble.
You can't go into the same bubble. And Raider just does this. This is, I love the crimeness of Raider holding these people, these children. You know, they're young adults, but very young kids against their will. I also like how we don't give a shit about any of these other writers who are getting their stories taken.
Never once. I was like, I'm glad that you pulled this from Wikipedia because I was like, how does Gary know there's four other writers in the bubbles?
I was keeping that in mind during the game because I was like, when the machine starts breaking down, other genres should start breaking in.
Oh, wouldn't that
like,
be fun?
What if we went into a side story that was like a noir? You know, it's such a good fucking idea, but the game just doesn't do it. So they appear in each other's stories.
Yeah, there are only three characters in this game, by the way.
Yes. I love the interns as well. The interns and the shadowy, the council.
The council is very good of like, because you can tell someone was like, well, we got to have some kind of Chinese person in there.
Yeah.
what are the different stereotypes of rich, evil person? Obviously, we got an old white guy. Maybe he's a little Teutonic.
Yeah. Old British lady and then a Chinese guy. It's like making backgrounds for the Guild of Calamitous Intent.
Yes.
Windows a little bit without knowing who they were going to be. So they go into each other's stories, Mio's and Zoe's story, and they're followed by this glitch that kind of messes up their environment. They approach the glitch, and this shunts them between stories. They decide what they're supposed to be doing is hunting down glitches. This is based on a lot of assumptions, but they're like, this is going to somehow save us.
Oh, it's because that's how the video game works.
Yeah, that is
how the video game works. They realize that they can't go to the next video game level unless they get to the end and touch the glitch.
Yes.
I'm being glib, but like, there's so often in this game, the characters are just like, let's do this.
They just decide it's the right thing to do. It's very unmotivated. Raider decides, hey, these ideas that we're getting are too valuable. We cannot shut down the machine. And one of my biggest issues with this game is what fucking ideas?
Let's get into what Raider's plan is. It's not revealed till a little later in the game. Exactly.
Yeah, but we can say it now.
This man has created, when we talked about this before, you slightly disagreed with me on it, but I'm just going to say it. This man has created the coolest machine in the world.
Yes.
He has created a device that if you go into it, it takes an idea in your head and creates a perfect, complete virtual reality environment you can run around in with no consequences and do whatever you want. And also, we later find out, the world's greatest therapy machine.
It does end up doing a lot of therapy for you.
Yeah.
I don't mind the idea of like a holodeck. You know, that part doesn't bother me. The weird idea of like submitting a story and then running around in it, that's fine. The idea is it also like sucks it out of you.
Like yeah, that's just like he has created this incredible virtual reality machine in service of stealing bad ideas from the worst writers in the world so he can make it's an AI metaphor. It's obviously an AI metaphor.
Yeah, he can make procedurally generated stories, which ironically, these character stories feel exactly like that already. Just very, very boring, very, very boilerplate. But his idea is if he steals all these stories from people, he will just kind of have them. Now, there's a weird... They were submitting their stories to be published. He had them. You know,
but he needs all of the stories. That's like the big evil twist is he's not just taking the story they chose to sell.
He wants all of their stories. So with this publisher, if you submit your manuscript, it gets all the manuscripts you've ever thought of, including ones when you were like seven. Like, you know, little fantasy stories you thought of when you were a tiny kid. Why? I don't know. There is no value to that.
Control of all human creativity is what they say in the video game, an actual line.
They do say that in the video game. He wants to have total global saturation of creativity.
When he's already made a fucking holodeck.
He owns a holodeck. And this is ostensibly for money.
Yeah.
You know, he talks about how much money it's going to make him. He does have a holodeck. So just to throw it out there, he also already owns the Raider Necroplex or whatever the fuck.
Yeah, it's a tall building. He's got two interns.
Yes, two people work there. No security until the very end.
No.
So that's his twist. He's going to get to the things that are dormant in your memory. You know, they decide to get more glitches. Zoe said, I love this in the Wikipedia. Zoe suggests finding more glitches and it may stabilize the system.
Sure.
Yeah,
that's cool what guess. Glitches do.
It might. They do. You know, Raider is going to spend a bunch of time trying to bribe them and try to convince them to relax. You know, not going to work. They go back and forth between fantasy and science fiction a bunch with a really irritating one-upsmanship. They start out with fantasy is dumb and sci-fi is cool as, and vice versa, as opinions held by them very strongly that nobody in real life has ever thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should maybe go back for a second and talk about our two main characters.
Yes.
The whole game lives and dies on how much you can stand these two people.
Yes. Mio is the sci-fi writer. She is a little bit more cynical. She likes action. And she's a little bit more guarded. She's less optimistic.
And Zoe is a smile machine, a happy, endlessly optimistic smile machine.
Zoe's along for the ride, but just you wait. In the end, there'll be kind of sort of hidden depths a little bit.
Yeah,
not as so dramatic and not as focused on as much.
Sorry, what was that, Gary?
Her depths are not as focused on or dramatic at the end. Like, she kind of gets this little postscript therapy.
Yeah, both of these characters, you can tell from minute one, have some sort of deep-seated trauma that is, in the one hand, making them super guarded and paranoid, and the other so aggressively cheerful that it looks like her face will fall off.
Yes. And they're constantly saying things like, science fiction, ooh, guns. I wish that there were fairies. Fairies are dumb. I wish there were spaceships. They just say things like that out loud to each other.
And it sounds like Gary's being reductive, but that could have been a line from the game.
I promise I'm not. One of the things about playing this game, one of the joys is constantly being surprised by how shameless and stupid the shallow these positions are. And it's not like something has to be realistic, you know, right? Like, part of the reason why this bothers me is because these characters do not feel real. These are disagreements no one's ever had. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are people who have a preference between sci-fi and fantasy. They go to the same convention. There's not a very big difference between those genres in real life. Like, they bleed together all the time.
And every human being you've ever met is better at articulating why they prefer one over the other than the characters in this game.
And cares about it less than this. Like, would never look down on somebody for not liking it. And the fact that they act like these weird machines to kind of parrot these points no one's ever had has a powerfully distancing effect to me. It's not just that it's unrealistic. I'm not dinging the sci-fi video game with the idea-sucking machine for being unrealistic generally. I'm saying that this is trying to tell a human story about human emotions, and these are the least human characters ever.
Yeah, they are not well observed. Mio also doesn't believe that writers put anything of themselves into their fiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Zoe's constantly what is this story saying about your life? She's like, what do you mean? It's just explosions. I like
them. Yeah, it's just lasers. I just think lasers are cool and violent. Oh, violence. I don't like that. I wish it was more like griffins. Again, could be an actual line. She fucking loves griffins. Griffins, manticores for girls. You know? The superiors
I can co-sign that, Gary.
they keep going back and forth. Raider keeps trying to stop them. He can't. They fight bosses and stuff. The superiors, Raider's shadowy council tells him to shut it down. He will not do it.
No, he's worked his whole life to make this machine.
To make the creativity sucky machine. Surprising no one, they slowly learn more about each other and become friends and start accepting their respective genres.
Friends and something more?
Perhaps. I go to AO3.
Gary, you keep talking while I check the AO3 for split fiction real fast.
I guarantee there's a lot of split friction on the AO3. But
Gary, bet me a dollar whether there's one called split friction.
I'll bet you a dollar. I hope so. If not, I'm going to write it because it needs to exist. These characters seem like powerful ace icons to me. This game is pleasingly sexless, even though I knew that people would make them make out.
Yeah. At no point is it in any way, shape, or form horny. There are 310 works listed here. The game came out 6 months ago or something, so good on them.
That's quite a trajectory there. Any split frictions?
Not on the first page.
Sucks. Come on.
Speedrun strats. Ooh.
Oh, is that the new fiction?
This is what happens when two women fit 6 months of bonding into roughly 12 hours. Things may not always look so rosy in the afterglow, but learning to love for real is better anyway.
Yeah. They do. This is the sexlessness of this is an extension of them having no interior lives.
Yeah.
Even though it's kind of about that. These characters are not able to hold two ideas at once, so they cannot flirt, you know, in their head. They become friends. You know, they say things like, oh man, actually swords are kind of cool. You know what? Lasers are kind of cool. Again, may as well actually be dialogue. This is showing that they're friends. Then we kind of enter into the climax after a long time of going back and forth of this.
Yeah, we go through two full stories from both of these characters. Then they get shoved down into their subconscious. Mm-hmm. And then the game finally does the thing you were expecting it to do the entire game, where it mashes up elements.
Yes. Zoe's fighting, or Mio is fighting Dark Mio with Zoe's help. You know, her trauma, she can win because she has a friend there. It turns out that Zoe is upset about her sister who died, who she more or less had drowned.
It's a little bit like if you've seen The Penguin. It's a little bit like that.
It's like The Penguin. Yeah.
Zoe in a lot of ways is like Oz Cobb the Penguin, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the prosthetics. That's sure. How you get that smile on there. You know, actually also played by Colin Firth.
Colin Firth. You've mixed your Collins like a fool.
That was a good joke if I didn't fuck that up.
What might have been, though, is what might have been. So heartbreaking.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, Gwen, fix it.
Make Gary have said Colin Farrell instead of Colin
Make it Firth. Funny. Gwen, make it funny. They keep fighting back until Raider decides to become a lawnmower man in the machine as the barriers between their subconscious and the two different styles of fiction are breaking down. Fight.
The very closest this game gets to satire is the idea that every tech bro is just a guy with a god complex and a lot of money.
Yeah, there's definitely like Elon Musk in him, even though he's more charming than Elon Musk. He doesn't sound as wooden and gross, which is weird. Defeating him destroys the machine.
Sure.
This is when the security shows up. Very funny. They can't get into the door, though. They don't have a key. We flash forward to where they're friends, and they've written a book called Split Fiction, which they leave on Mio's father's grave. Very funny.
Yeah, we didn't talk about it. Mio's dad has cancer and is he's sick, and
she wants to get money, so she's going to become a writer to pay for his treatment. She's got. I made a story about what if people shot laser guns dressed up as Iron Man. I'm going to use this to pay for your treatment. Squid Game, it is not. I kept joking about, we're going to go by my sister's grave too, right? 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 At the end, they don't. But they're best friends.
Her sister's grave is probably in England. Zoe is Zoe English?
She has an English accent, but it's hard to tell. I figured her grave would be underwater, but I could be wrong about that. So
why did you think her grave would be underwater? Because she drowned?
Yeah, because I thought it would be funny. I don't know.
Funny. I'm sorry. I know you're used to getting softball layups funny. In this show with your comedy.
Gwen will make you laugh.
Let me give just a clean laugh for Gwen to use, because I edit Guppy, so I know how hard this can be.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you. I'll take it.
Because if it sounded full throated, the listener wouldn't believe it.
No. Well, there's also effects we can put on to make it sound more full throated. Like, we do a whole bunch of post-processing to make me seem funnier. So
that's overall the plot of the game. There's a little more to it than what we've said.
There's a lot of the middle of the plot of this that feels really running in place to me. One of my big issues with the pacing of this is I think there's one too many zone for each of them here. And this is putting aside, you spend a lot of time on these side stories, and I can't complain about those because, like, mechanically, those are my favorite bits. And story-wise, those are my favorite parts, period. I was always looking for those because they would be fun. They would be a change-up.
Like, the thing is, each character only gets three sections in the game. Yes. It's just each section is like 3 hours long.
It's quite a long game. It's longer than any of their other games. Like, not long, you know, like Red Dead Redemption 2 long, but long for what it is.
So, like, here, Mio gets, her first one is Cyber Ninja Revenge. Which is, at first I thought it might literally just be about parking tickets. Like, there's the antagonist of it is constantly talking about you have to pay your debts. It's about medical debt and like taxes and stuff.
Yes. It's double subterfuge. She's masking her anxiety about medical debt with debt about parking tickets. Mm-hmm. here. I also liked that. If that was her trauma, that would be funny. One of the frustrating things about this game is that it will verve into something that would be very funny as parody.
Yes.
And then not do it.
Because also from like minute 10, maybe you're like, oh, these characters both have deep seated traumas that they are trying not to talk about. And I'm going to spend the next several hours getting them to very slowly open up about it.
It's also the real quick while I'm, you know, people not acting real, just the idea that these two characters, one of them's like, I like sci-fi, I don't like fantasy that strongly. The idea of having an opinion that characters, that writers do not draw on personal experiences.
Completely insane. A completely insane
thing to say.
Yeah.
Like there's current discourse around that with people, you know, the curtain was blue because it was blue, right? That's like a thing that's going around where people are angry about subtext. And like many things, the truth is actually like a little in the middle. Like it I think it can be annoying to assign symbolism to every single possible thing.
Sure, but stories are usually about
something. It's not about a cyber ninja going and fighting robots. You know, that's not fiction. Like, that's not art. And this is a real, but even if you are a literalist, characters will just say what things are about. You know, you don't have to be, you know, pick up on symbolism and subtext necessarily to have a story be about something. There are several stories that are just about what they say they're about. But they do say they're about something. It's not just about the action that's on screen, right?
One thing I think about a lot with this game is how dog shit these stories must be.
Oh, they're the fucking worst. Like, Raider wants to get his hands on this stuff, and the story is about them walking through corridors?
Yeah, or like, okay, and then the cyber ninja jumped, did like a double jump and then a dash to the side. Like, even if you're not doing that, I'm joking, like, if you're not doing that moment-to-moment gameplay as the writing, then it's just, and then they hijacked a car, and they were flying through the sky, and then they crashed, and then it's...
There are almost no NPCs in these characters, in these stories?
Yeah, like, almost. Sometimes you'll get an antagonist that talks, but almost never.
Pretty rarely. It's almost like Raider invented a machine to download the entirety of GameFAQs.
Yes.
And is trying to create all creativity with that. It's fucking dumb.
I would love if at the end we fought a giant thing that
CJC.
Said, yes, or if this is posted anywhere except GameFAQs, you are reading it illegally.
Yeah, just a huge stamp comes down and tries to hit you, and of course it makes rings that you have to jump over. I want to camp on the dialogue for a little bit. We talked about it a lot, but and we're kind of talking about it now. But this is a dialogue failure. The dialogue in this is very clunky. In addition to characters having saying things that no one would ever say or having opinions no one ever say, there is tons of really, really sub-Marvel movie quipping shit.
These are jokes that aspire to the elegance and grace of "They fly now, they fly now."
It's but like worse even. Like
that's what
literally
I'm saying.
Do,
they aspire to that.
Yeah, yeah.
But at their best, they hit an "They fly now" moment.
At one point, I think they literally do say "They fly now." That's great. Fighting these drones. I think that literally happens in it. But characters, and they talk constantly. Imagine if you had like a speed or a crank disease where you had to do a quip about the current situation you're in every 10 seconds or so.
Gary, you just flashed me back to every stream I've ever been on.
Yeah. It sucks.
No.
Imagine people who
aren't
as fun as
me.
Will having to keep the ball in the air. No matter what. They can't talk about their real life because they're guarded about that. You know, and they also weirdly don't talk about their situation other than just making assumptions like, oh, there's glitches. Okay. You know, we got to get the glitches. Okay, let's move that out of the way. Now let's just say stuff like "They fly now."
Every once in a while, they're like, hey, this actually looks pretty cool. And I'm like,
yeah.
Good. At least you're kind of enjoying the fact that you're in the amazing holodeck.
Yeah. And also, so, you know, oh, this actually looks pretty cool. I was wrong about fantasy as a thing. Thematically, what this is trying to do, there's a couple of things. It's talking to, there's themes about again using art to work through trauma.
Mm-hmm. The game believes that is a good thing. You should do that.
Yes, it is a good and necessary thing.
After your friend makes you, because you don't believe it's possible.
Yeah, because you have to be convinced the theme exists. Themes, do they exist? Hazelight.
I wrote this story about a giant dying beast constantly being prodded at by medical technicians, and I wrote it while I was spending time with my father who's dying of cancer. I don't know why I did that.
It's just about beasts.
It's just about beasts.
And the only way you can realize that's your trauma and you get past it is with the power of friendship, right? It's a big friendship thing at the end of this. When Mio is fighting Dark Mio, like, she literally turns to her at the end and is like, I made it because of my, because you're a friend. You know, they just say it out loud.
Yeah. As a thing. And I want to, like, we'll talk sugar about stuff in this game, but there are clever moments, like, usually happening in the play there, like in that Dark Mio.
Yes.
So they get shoved into their subconscious, right? This is the last, like, big beat before the finale. So they run through this big prison with this ominous prisoner.
It's weirdly enough, it's the penultimate beat because we still do the Zoe part.
Yeah.
With the centipedes.
Each character has to do their trauma one at a time, even though you would think using the split mechanic, you could run both at the same time to be a little more efficient.
It really felt like the end of this Mio. It's like, oh, that feels like the end of the game. I can't believe Zoe's got a thing.
It's a huge emotional climax. And then they're like, well, got to do the other one. We got two characters.
And then it's like, oh, the lady whose sister drowned? Oh, I guess she probably has something about that. Oh, these parents are centipedes? Okay.
You sound insane describing, like...
Yeah, it sounds cooler than it is, but it is very funny.
But I meant to say, there are moments like at the end of that Dark Mio fight, which is a dog shit boss fight.
I want to talk about it. We have play stuff a little bit later. I want to talk about the boss fights in this in general, but it is a bad one.
I want to highlight a moment that I like, which is also actually something that, speaking of Dark Pictures games, they do it a couple times there too. There is a tappa-tappa at the end of that fight that both characters have the prompt for. And what the Mio player has to realize is that they need, if they're tappa-tappa-ing, they are pushing against Zoe helping them.
Yes.
And so you have to let go of the controller and let it happen. That's great. I'm not saying it's genius, but that is a very smart integration of play and story as an idea.
It's really good. It reminds me of one of my favorite player story interfaces, which I can't remember if I talked to you about this specifically, because it's ancient history in terms of video games. But something like that happens at the climax of the first season of The Walking Dead, where you are strangling the antagonist, you know, the person who has as your surrogate child. And if you stop when the game tells you to stop, he gets away. Mm-hmm. But if you just keep doing it after the game keeps telling you, if you're just that passionate about it, you'll kill him.
Yeah.
And the game stops signaling that you can do that. It reminds me of that. And that's really clever. I eat that shit up.
Yeah.
I think
that, and that is like, we'll talk about it more, but there are these little dollops of great ideas interspersed into this dough of just the most generic dialogue and storytelling you will ever feel.
And fairly, I want to put a pin in this because I want to talk about it later, but also more often than I would like, fairly generic play.
Yes.
Even when it's fun.
Yeah.
You know, the there are these really high points of it that I think are really taking advantage of the medium and doing something interesting with co-op. There are infinite, it feels like, scenarios where one person can manipulate the level and the other person has to move through it in really minor variations.
Mm-hmm.
That happens a lot. So, like, thematically, this doesn't – whatever this is trying to say either is already said and is not really worth saying. It's just an assumed thing. Or it fumbles. I don't feel like there is a strong statement about art or friendship or creativity in this.
Yeah. The other major thematic thing it's trying to do is to be a conversation about AI. And I'm someone who thinks AI is dog shit. My industry is actively under attack from AI. I really think that 99.999% of the time, you are not getting back anything remotely what you are spending to get it, right?
Yep.
I don't think this game has one interesting thing to say about that debate.
No, not even a little bit. And it's such a layup, right? Like, we are living in the middle of that right now. It is being forced down our throats constantly by everyone. I don't know anyone who likes it. I know they exist. They have to. But I don't know anybody. The arguments against it are obvious and there's passion behind them. People feel very strongly about it. You get the sense that this is something they wanted to talk about, but they don't have very strong feelings about it, and they're not very well thought out.
I mean, it's literally just, it's bad. It eats human creativity, and it's bad. Yeah, I know, man. I don't need to play your video game to know that. You need to say something more about it than it's just tech bros are jealous of artists and want to eat their creativity to endlessly shit out masterpieces that they don't understand aren't masterpieces because they have no human craft to them.
Yeah, because they're jealous. You know,
I can get that in 6 seconds on Blue Sky, man. You don't need to make a video game about it.
You don't even have to want to get it on Blue Sky. It just happens into you.
Yeah.
You log on to Blue Sky and you get that take because it's the correct take. It reminds me a lot of in high school when it's something a teacher told me, you know, we were doing speech and doing debates and saying you can't do your speech subject on world hunger because everyone's against world hunger. Like, well, you can talk about the parts of it. You can talk, you got to be more specific, basically. This game is not doing it being specific.
I mean,
you're pro.
I kind of like it. I think. I don't want to like go off on my soapbox here, but I'm mildly pro world hunger.
No, you have the floor. We're making good time.
Well, it's like, you know how in Mad Max Fury Road, the hero says, don't let yourself become addicted to water.
I do know that scene.
Yeah. The hero gets up and reminds everyone that water is just an addiction. If you let yourself get addicted to it, it's the same way I feel about happiness, really. But just, yeah, maybe we don't need as much food, right? Or maybe food. Just some people need all the food.
It makes me wish there was a cut of Fury Road where instead of saying don't get addicted to the water, he said don't get addicted to the food. And when he pulled the big lever, tons of McDoubles poured down onto the people.
Or just gazpacho?
Yeah. You could do that in an edit. You can make what actually poured out as gazpacho.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a filter. Hey, Gwen, could you go back and edit the episode so I don't sound like a sociopath? I forgot I don't do that on this show.
Yeah. It's hard not to gup. But it's good. I like it. Giving everybody a little taste. If you like this, Everything Grumpy's not actually that much like it, but a little bit. You know, it would this bit would be a whole episode of Everything Grumpy.
Sure, it would just be me going on and on about how people should starve and how I think that's good.
It's a deeply political show. It's largely a soapbox for your values, and if you want that, and you're sick of being fed lies, you know, by the media. Go to Guppy.
Lies or sandwiches. I don't like either.
Mm-hmm. No good. But you know, the characters who made this don't have anything to say about AI other than it's bad. That lack of specificity kills it. You know, there are so many arguments to make against it. Moving kind of into play, which we've generally been fairly sugarous about, there is a really big gulf between those moments, like you mentioned during that boss fight, or some very cool play moments, which we'll talk about later, and what you're doing, you know, in standard levels, which I think is pretty boring.
A lot of the time, yeah. Yeah, so you do have a core move set. Both characters can dash, they can double jump, and they can air dash. Like basically every single level you do has that as the core stuff they can always do.
Yep. And then all this stuff works. It's relatively fun.
It's fine. You don't usually bounce off of a thing you were expecting to wall jump off of or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Like wall jumping is a little bit telegraphed. Like, oh, here's a section with wall jumps. Here's a section with slides, you know, and it repeats that. But it's fine. You know, more or less funnish to do that. The kind of problem is each world or side story gives you a unique mechanic for this. And it's hard to count the number of them where it's just you become two different kinds of creatures or get two different kinds of objects, and one of you can interact with green things and one of you can interact with purple things. And you get to the end of a path and it's a green thing. The green person has to interact with it. That opens up a purple thing for the purple thing to interact with it. And then you can move on. And mild complications on that. They do that a lot.
Yeah. I think I'm a little warmer on this aspect of it than you are. At least in part because I'm still kind of a sucker for like the bits where Zoe becomes the level and Mio then has to navigate it. I think that stuff, because those are the moments where there's the most like collaboration and cooperation with your partner.
Yeah.
I think that works pretty well.
Just real quick, I want to throw in there. Part of the reason why I'm not as warm on it is because It Takes Two is all that, basically.
Yeah, that's
as well.
What I figured.
Yeah, like it's a cool, I like it too. It just gets repeated too many times for me.
A lot of times, though, it is just, hey, here's a wall that only responds to monkey punches. Here's a thing you grab out of the air because you have the tree branches.
Yes. Yeah. And there is, we talked to you and mentioned this earlier, there's a little bit of a disparity between how cool the abilities are. Mm-hmm. It's a real bummer when, like, for example, one of the good ones, like the side story thing when you're the pigs, when Derek was playing, Derek could do like the launch and everything, and all I could do was stretch out.
Yeah, okay, so you were playing as Zoe, who can just kind of go, like, spring up, whereas Derek was playing as the pig who can magically fart rainbows to glide across the environment.
Significantly more fun. You know, sometimes you get a character whose power is to, like, grip a thing and turn it. You know, whereas the other character might have a fun, expressive movement ability, things like that.
The other thing is, I don't think the game does a great job. This feels like it would be such a good opportunity to further characterize Mio and Zoe.
Yeah, that
and,
yeah.
And there's a little bit of it. There's a little bit of it. Zoe turns into a big, or Mio turns into a big monkey that can break stuff. Whereas Zoe turns into the little fairy that can like float on air. Yeah. It is not consistent throughout the game, I don't think.
No. And the characters aren't deep enough to have multiple avenues of that to explore. When they do explore that, it's always just going to be one of them slightly more aggressive and guarded, and one of them's more gentle than the other, because they just have those singular traits. Like, they're too flat of characters to do neat stuff with this, to reveal through how they transform.
It feels like such a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
Like, there's a late game thing where the most elaborate of these, you are raising dragons throughout the level. And every time the dragons get older, they get new powers. So by the end of it, you each have two or three powers.
Yeah.
And like,
they're okay. To me, they're okay. Like, some of them are neat.
It's fine. It's a lot of like lock and key stuff of like figuring out, oh, what's the timing here to do that?
Yes. Yeah. Not always. Sometimes they're legitimately neat things that happen in it. I want to talk sugar for like a minute about this, like talk about some stuff that really worked here. That sequence is great. There are a bunch of them that I think are standouts. One of the things before I played this was people talked about how cool the ending was. And the ending is cool, where they kind of mix the fictions.
There's two conceits to the ending section. There are sections of it where you are looking at the same level, but Mio is seeing it through a sci-fi lens and Zoe is seeing it through a fantasy lens. And they can sometimes interact with it in different ways. Like, there's a computer there for Mio that isn't there for Zoe and things like that.
In Shadowrun terms, the metaphor is different over it. So if you're imagining fourth edition Shadowrun, which I know you are.
Everyone is.
There's a different metaphor over the experience for them. That stuff's pretty neat. And the other conceit
that they do there is you can start, there are sections where you move across the dividing line of the split screen.
Yes.
So you're literally moving back and forth between the two universes. That, A, it doesn't wear out its welcome, and B, it just feels really cool.
Yeah, it's really neat looking. Disorienting at first, and things start happening with the actual split screen actually moves at different angles and moves over and everything in a way that's really neat. That's sick. I would have liked a lot more of that in the game, but then the game would also have to be very short.
Yeah.
To have a lot more of that, because like it not wearing out its welcome is very important.
Because God, sometimes, it does. It does.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes the game is actually funny. Not that often, but every once in a while, something kind of funny happens. Another famous sequence in this is the hot dog sequence, the pig sequence. This was funny and weird to me.
That is a good moment. I think they screw it up a little bit by later in the game doing the dentist sequence, which is kind of the same gag.
Yes. Yeah. But the section where you're pigs, you do the entire life cycle of a pig, including being turned into sausages, and then like cook yourself and position yourself as sausages onto buns.
Yeah, you've got to like one player has to like get under the mustard and the ketchup, even though if you put ketchup on a hot dog, you've got mental problems.
Well, these characters, they have a lot of stuff to work through.
Yeah, I think at the end of the game, they wouldn't be putting that.
No, because they learn about friendship.
Yeah. Gary, do you put ketchup on a hot dog?
Depends.
On what?
I love a Chicago style.
Do you hate yourself that day or not?
I don't hate ketchup the way that you do. It depends on what I have also to put on the hot dog. If I have other, like a good amount of other fixings, no.
Anything?
No, I don't want to do a hot dog with just mustard on it.
Well, no, you have to put the little onions on it too.
I don't always have the little onions.
Well, get the little onions, Gary. All you have to do is chop up a fucking onion.
I love the little onions. I love a Chicago-style hot dog. Like, I love a hot dog without ketchup, but a lot of times hot dogs, it's the only port in the storm. I need something on the hot dog.
Because I used to live in Chicago.
Yeah. And it is the best quality of hot dog. Celery salt.
You also call out in this bit in the notes, the pinball sequence.
Yes.
So late game, you get shoved down into your subconscious. And for some reason that gives you both of your characters drone powers.
Yes.
This is, I think, a section where Mio gets way cooler powers than Zoe does.
Yeah.
Mio has like a swarm of nanomachines that can transform into different stuff. There's a really good bit there where she can like be a boat that Zoe has to ride around in that I think is really cool.
Yep. And Zoe has magnet powers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you don't have to, I kept overthinking this. I kept thinking you had to aim them or be closer. You just turn it on or off.
Yeah.
Well, that's how magnets work. You know what? That's true.
ICP. We figured it out.
We figured it out, idiots. There's a pinball section where one of your characters is a pinball and the other one is controlling the machine.
Yeah, Mio hacks into the machine, so she's controlling the flippers while Zoe is the little Samus Aran ball.
Is moving around. That was a blast.
It's great.
When people talked about the end of the game being a showstopper, I assume this is what it was because this was so fucking fun. What it reminded me of is when we were in Duckstream and we were doing the mixed controller Mario World.
Mm-hmm.
Which is some of the most fun I've had at Duckstream. Like, I love that as a thing.
Yeah. The McElroy brothers.
It's another thing the McElroy brothers went back in time to steal from me.
Yeah.
But the that idea of you're just kind of intuiting. Obsessed with
Griffins.
Yeah. they're McElroys for boys. The idea of that kind of mind melding. You know, where we're both intuitively doing something without having to talk about it to get through this stuff. Like, it fires that, and that's really special to me.
Yeah.
And super, super funny. Super fun. Or not funny, fun. The biggest thing here, I think, is that there's an idea here for the best version of this game based on the premise that didn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think about that? Like, if you were going to remake something with these basic parts, what would be the kind of thing you would make?
I think the game would be about half as long and I'd ride it.
Yeah, that's great. Ship it. I'll stick you in the machine to steal that.
Yeah. You know? I think for the most part, most of these another thing I forgot to talk about during the demerits section, because I'm a negative person. Mm-hmm. A lot of these play sections for me, I wrote this in my review. Sometimes what you're doing thinks it's being cool when what it's really just being is loud.
Yeah.
Like, there's a big jet ski section at the end of Mio's second story that's supposed to be triumphant. You've released the father beast, and you're escaping, and everything's exploding constantly and yelling, and there's like fireworks and shit. And what you're actually doing with your controller is moving the D-pad left and right a little bit.
Yep.
It's also a very crappy version of the escape sequence of Resident Evil 4.
It's a very bad version of that with, a kind, you know, very generous, but almost aggressively generous checkpointing, you know?
Yeah.
If you die during any of these sections, it just catches you back up immediately.
Yeah. Where in the rest of the game, it's slightly more rigorous where the dying player has to tappa tappa. And if the other player dies before the tappa tappa is done, you lose progress.
Only during bosses.
Yeah.
Does that happen? And the bosses are also very aggressively checkpointed. The game does not want you to have to redo things.
Yeah, because it knows that its boss fights are already boring as shit.
Yeah, they're not very good. The version that's half as long and better written would work. I really wish that other genres had made their way in.
Yeah, and, they play around with this with the side stories. And the side stories, again, are great. I kind of want to run through the side stories.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of them in my standout moments as a thing. But we can certainly run through them because they are good. Like, they're my favorite part. I would play a game that's just that, too. Get rid of the macro plot and just play a short story compilation.
Absolutely. But they are still pretty rooted in Mio and Zoe's perspectives.
Yes.
So yeah, we're not getting a Western. We're not getting a noir. It's pretty two-tone in its palette.
Yep. The two stock different kinds of or one stock sci-fi, one stock fantasy. It's always the same. Any other kind of like specific what's rights here that aren't, you know, more generalized rather before we kind of go through some side stories, then go through our final highlights and everything.
No, I think we've touched on most of it. When the cooperative play is doing anything clever, it's really clever. Again, this is a game with more clever ideas in it than most games I play. It's just that they're spread out throughout a lot of pretty stock stuff, buoyed up with some pretty subpar writing.
Yep. Yeah. Some real slop. Those highlights, it's the kind of thing, you know, that kind of moves it, you know, is a wrap up kind of thought for this, but this idea that like Hazelight justifying its existence, right? Like this is every one of these games that I've enjoyed and had huge asterisks with, I'm still glad they're there and I will probably play their next game because of those moments. They're good enough to play, but as a holistic work, it kind of sucks. So it's a little bit hard to reckon with.
And I think we'll probably say this again in the wrap up thoughts, but having a friend there to roll your eyes with at the dialogue,
yes,
it does do a lot of spackling.
It made me think about how excruciating it would be if you were with somebody. It was the opposite. You had somebody who was taking you very seriously.
Oh my God.
You know, and was not like rolling their eyes, and they're just like, oh man, shut up. She's talking about her dentist. Shut up. You know, and just like trying to imagine that. That's an alienating feeling, like when you sit down to show somebody something and they don't like it. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, you got to watch the sketch. They don't like it. It'd be like that, but for 12 hours. Horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible. Let's go through the side stories. A bunch of these are my kind of highlights as well. So this will kind of take care of that.
Yeah.
For that. I've got the walkthrough open here to kind of look at them and see what they are.
So yeah. So side story number one, they have names, I guess. The Legend of the Sandfish. This one's kind of mandatory, and it's one of the lesser ones of these. It's kind of a vaguely Arabian-themed area where you're sliding on sand, and there is a fun little mechanic where you're having to set up pounders to walk without rhythm some sand sharks.
Yeah.
So you can cross some slow-moving, some like quicksand stuff. But
reference-y. This one, you know, I don't barely remember it. The next one is the pig one, which we mentioned. Yeah. The pig one's great. And one of the reasons why it's great, one of my favorite things that the side stories can do in this and also happen in Takes Two and in A Way Out is just you hang around. Like they
I wanted to talk about. I'm so glad you brought this up.
Yeah. They give you a zone just to kind of be in. The best part of A Way Out is the part where you're at the farmhouse.
Yeah. I mean, technically, it's the best part of A Way Out is playing Connect Four, which is a better game than A Way Out.
Yeah. But again, they do put a fully functional Connect Four in there.
Yeah.
And Connect Four is fun. But having little doodads you can fuck around with while you're hanging out with your friend.
And they're just kind of chatting. The jokes are not execrable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fart jokes, you know, but.
Yeah, it's you know, at some point Zoe wrote a story about two pigs who fart rainbows who get turned into sausages and dressed in a non-Chicago style. Pretty fun. Like really fun just to hang out.
Right. It's the first thing in the game that really looks like distinct.
It's not just fantasy jungle. It's not like Oblivion palette for something. The next one we have is the mountain hike.
Yeah.
This is one of Zoe's stories where you're going up a mountain.
And there's giants everywhere that are helping you.
Yeah.
The only thing I actually find notable about this one is that this is the only side story that I think is kind of easy to miss.
Yeah.
We should talk about that briefly. Narratively, they're doing the side stories to like save them from Raider. There is nothing to turn or there's nothing in this game you do to change the outcome of the story whatsoever. This is a strictly linear thing.
Yeah. These are portals you see. Your characters will comment on them when they see them, but some like this one is a little bit hard to miss.
Yeah, this is the one they don't comment on. And it's behind you when you get into an area. So I completely missed it my first time through.
Yeah. They'll literally say, hey, there's a side story, we should check that out. But this one they don't.
Oh, and they are kind of neat because around the portal, the side story bleeds into the reality a little bit, which is, again, mm-hmm. the kind of shit I wish the game was doing all the time.
Yeah. So you'll be in a fantasy zone and there'll be like a terminal.
Yeah.
Like a sci-fi terminal there. The next one is called Train Heist. This is like a shooter or shoot 'em up, mm-hmm. rather.
I did this one maybe 6 days ago and still barely remember it.
Yeah, not a whole lot to it. It's a nice gameplay switch up.
Yeah, you're chasing a train, and then when you get to the train, you do shmup stuff.
Yep.
And it's not a very good shmup.
Yeah, whenever you put a shmup in another game, it's never good. Big shout out to the Jade Empire shmups.
Jesus.
Everyone forgot about. The next one I really like, there's a game show where the idea, it's like a dystopian, you know, death game show.
Mia has come up with this amazing idea of what if there was a kind of feminine coded computer on like a hanging down gamble, yeah. That's kind of sarcastic. Happios? And mean to you?
Yeah, like what? Kind of Happios or like kind of a Cheerfulos.
Yeah, I like that, Gary. I don't think they say that in the game, but that's a good name for it.
Yeah, it's something about like, but it's actionably GLaDOS.
Who?
Happios.
Okay, there we are.
Yeah.
Amazing. You know, I really dog on Mio for not having any creative ideas, but damn, she really came up with one.
Yeah.
A computer that's passive aggressive. Amazing.
Yeah, really, really good. I think this game is good and kind of hard.
Kicks ass. This is the coolest bit of game, like straight, like actual challenge, having to coordinate gameplay. You have a bomb. You're trying to deliver a bomb to the end of an obstacle course. If one player holds the bomb for too long, it goes off.
Mm-hmm.
In a very nasty, clever touch, throwing is a button and catching is a button.
Yep.
You can't just kind of hurl it and have it like auto magnet into the other player's hands. They have to know the bomb is coming and hit the button. It's not complicated most of the time, but you do have to say like, hey, throwing, catching, throwing.
Yep.
You have to like do that back and forth, and it's really cool.
And you are moving through an obstacle course, two obstacle courses, as you do this, and you need to stay roughly on par with each other because you cannot hold the bomb for too long or it'll blow up.
One thing I liked about it is the courses are mirrored, and they get more complex. You do this, I think, 5 or 6 times. But one thing I ended up doing while I was doing that is, because you need to keep track of where the other player is, because if you don't have a sight line, you can't throw. Mm-hmm. I would take my perspective and turn it to the side so I could see my friend's level. And I would and I would use that to navigate my level because they were mirrored. So the game was forcing me to do a trick with the perspective that was like really cool.
It's really neat. And this and the pinball felt like they could be full games to me.
Absolutely.
Not full 12-hour games, but like there was something here. Really loved this. I thought this was great. Next one's okay. It's another sci-fi one where you're in a sci-fi zone that's collapsing and there are pulses. You have to get behind shields and you can create shields for yourself.
Yeah.
As a thing.
This has a clever moment at the end.
Yeah.
Where
your shields are on a refractory period and you have to realize that you can be under the same shield.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go solo, you will get hit before you can recharge. But if you ping pong, if you kind of juggle them, you'll stay protected.
Yeah, that is a good moment to figure out. And also, again, is like one of those things that's like, oh, this is thematically on point. This is like using the play to reinforce the themes of the game.
Yep, pretty good. There's one called Kites, which I barely remember.
It's like, a race. It's very short. It's Bad Pilot Wings with a racing element.
Moon Market, which I think is really good. This is literally just a fuck around one where you are in a fantasy, like, you know, market zone where there's just a lot of things to mess around with for kind of light comedy.
Yeah, I mean, it's explicitly Rowling coded.
Yes, it is a little Rowling coded. Yeah, that is true. I just didn't want to say, but it's Diagon Alley or whatever.
Yeah.
You take a potion that turns you into the next thing you touch or whatever, and you turn into a sign, and you run around as a sign, or you get a magic wand that will paralyze things, and you do it on the mushroom men and pigs that are walking around.
Or you can turn them into chairs and then sit on them and then just sit and watch that for a while you process how that feels.
Yeah, to process your grief or whatever you're going through with this art about
grief is
what if
I'm
there
processing
was an alley.
While I've turned another sentient being into a chair and sat on it. Yeah, I'm feeling grief.
Yeah, and the chair can kind of still
so
move
much
around.
Grief. Oh my
I'm,
God.
I'm griefing to completion. It's so hot for me that my look under the AO3 tag for grief and find a lot of me sitting on a chair to completion.
This one feels like it might have been a draft for a full Zoe level that did, and then they were like, no, the levels need to be more linear.
Because all you do is go find some cats.
Yeah.
In it, like the actual gameplay part, but the hang around part is really fun.
And there's a ton of mechanics in it too. Like you get all these different little spells and stuff.
Yeah, really neat.
Also has the Dark Souls reference in it.
Yeah, yep, you can find a bonfire in it.
Very and cute. They do sit down like you do sit at the bonfires, and it's, I think, does it pop a little Dark Souls text thing? I think it does.
It says something. And then also one of the characters turns to the camera and goes, I'm Velka, actually.
Yeah, we finally found him. Oh, and the other one says, enjoying this big cup of Solaire soup.
Yep, they do the memes and the lore. This next one sucks, the notebook one.
It's very coded like a 2009 indie game. I grant that.
Like a specific 2009 indie game. Like I played games that are just this.
I know. It looks nice though. It's short.
It is short. It does look nice. Yeah. I'd agree with that. This is a side scroller, but where it's in a drawn style, and one character is narrating over it and changing what happens. Like,
yeah, Zoe is narrating it. There's a couple points where you choose what meme-y fucking thing you fight.
Yep, and then that's what gets drawn into fight.
They say giant enemy crab. This has one cool moment at the end where you've been side scrolling the whole time, and then it suddenly turns into a 3D world that still has that same sketchbook aesthetic. Looks really cool.
Yeah, it looks, I think I would have been, if I hadn't seen variations of this, I would have been, like, it's in a vacuum, it's cool. Yeah. There's a snowboarding level. I like snowboarding in games, also really short. Nothing really special. I just like snowboarding.
Everything's, it's a Mio story, so everything's also exploding and being destroyed by drills and stuff.
Yeah, a lot of explosions. Another leaving an exploding station. In this one where the kind of gimmick is there are oxygen containers, you have limited oxygen, you float between oxygen stations where you have to do a little mini game to fill up your oxygen and then make it to the next one in time.
And then finally there's the birthday cake one, which is Mio's first story, which is like a child world full of candy. And then you fight a Psychonauts dentist at the end. And it feels a lot like they're retreading what the really fun reveal of the pig.
Was. Yes. Yeah, basically the same thing. And it's just another boss fight here.
One weird thing about the side stories is once you get pushed down into the subconscious, which is about three quarters of the way through the game, you don't do them anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, they get rid of them, which is a shame because they're my favorite part of the game.
Yeah, I miss it.
I'm looking at my standout moments and all of them are side stories except for the ending. You know, it's worth talking about that dentist boss because I want to talk about bosses in this game a little bit. Mm-hmm. They are at best pretty functional. You know, for a co-op third-person 3D boss fight, they repeat a very limited set of tricks in these.
Yeah, like the very first boss fight you have, you wait for him to do a move. Like you dodge his moves, most of which are either they paint the target on the ground and you don't stand there, or he puts out waves you have to jump over.
Yep.
And you wait for him to do the move that lets you pick up his weapon and hit him with it. And then you shoot him for a while. And then you do that fucking four times.
Yep. Every one of them has a bunch of phases that get slightly faster and maybe have slightly more moves. So much of it is downtime. You know, it's really dodge. And that's fine. That's a fine idea for a boss fight. It's not a fine idea for all of your boss fights.
Yeah.
I feel like. Not exaggerating, like you just do that a lot. I feel like there might be one boss that does not pound something down to create ring, like Bowser rings you jump over.
Yeah.
Maybe one in this whole game. Like,
if I'm thinking about like standout boss fights in this, I think the best one. So we haven't really talked about all the mechanics that you use in the levels. There's one level that is kind of weird insofar as Zoe and Mio have the same power set. They have guns. Mm-hmm. This is the level where you're saving Zoe's cancer monster dad. Yes. Mio's cancer monster. And weirdly, because both players have the same power set, they're just tuned to different colors. I feel like it gives them a little bit more freedom to get interesting with the gameplay.
A little bit, but it's a little bit more, it's more interesting with the gameplay, but in a way that isn't doing anything uniquely split fiction.
Yeah, the gunplay in it is not good.
No, like I have a note here. Basically, whenever my character has a gun, I'm a little bit bored.
Yeah.
In this, typically what your gun can do is charge up things of your color or get rid of force fields of your color. Mm-hmm. Really, again, very standard things that happen in games that borrow a little co-op bit for this.
Yeah, but there is a fight in that against a big machine where you have to, like, one player has to launch the other one up into the air to, like, take out the targets on its back.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
I had fun with that.
With the launchers, the arena where you have the launchers across the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I would agree with that. Like, that's fairly fun.
But again, I'm having to reach for a boss fight I actually liked in this because they're... Most of the time, you're waiting for the boss to do something that makes it vulnerable to one of your movesets, and then the other player comes in and punches it a bunch.
It's hard for me to remember very many of these bosses through that. Like, I didn't remember that one until you mentioned it. So many of them are just like a robot. Like, what if a robot?
It's so many robots. Every Mio only ever has you fighting robots, and it's just...
That's sci-fi.
They have no identity to them.
Yeah. It's why it's the best genre. So this is a real problem in this game. You do a lot of boss fights in this, I feel like. The other thing I really want to mention that I liked in the finale, during the Zoe finale, which again feels like a coda, you're riding her parents, which are centipedes. Mm-hmm. And you're doing pretty fun stuff of like gripping you. They're like ropes. And there's a part where it's kind of platforming where you are bionic commandoing across platforming
it's things. It's heave-hoeing legally.
Heave-hoing, yes. Indie game. Well, Bionic Commando walks, so heave-ho could run.
You don't really run in heave-ho. You swing like a beautiful swinging beast. But that part has kind of two big sections. So you're one centipede with two heads. You're each controlling one of the heads.
Yes.
So there's a fun section where you have to like navigate up like a lava path without dragging the middle of your body through the lava. I like that.
I like that a lot.
And then you get to this part where you are each controlling one of the heads and you are swinging on wheels that are turning and grabbing nodes and stuff. Really fun.
Yeah. I thought that was really cool. Like the right level of demanding, you know, there's a little bit of rigor to it. It's not, you know, super hard, but it was at least a little bit hard. Like I had to think about it.
Yeah. Nothing in this game is super hard. Like Jen noted to me a couple times when we played through that she doesn't play a lot of shooters, a lot of like timing based games. And with a couple little exceptions, basically the bomb throwing game, this was still a very smooth playthrough.
It's because they want you to experience the story.
Yeah, the amazing narrative.
Amazing, you got to get through it. Are there any other big high points or low points we didn't touch that you want to touch on before we kind of get into wrap-up thoughts?
When I'm thinking about cute little moments, there is a very funny bit in one of the Mio stories where you are you've hijacked some vehicle or something. Mm-hmm. And Mio is flying it while Zoe is being forced to do a series of phone jokes to authenticate that it's like you're having to like swipe through. You have to click EULAs to like scroll down them. They make you do captchas with like click all the boxes.
Yes.
Genuinely very funny. It's happening on a very tight timer and there's no actual consequence for failure, but it's genuinely... It really got a laugh out of me.
Yeah, no, that was great. It reminds me, like, a lot of the high points of this feel like they could have supported a short indie game on their own.
Yeah.
Like, that feels like a browser game to me, like a good browser game that people would enjoy. When it's at its best, like, it's a thing that could support itself. Yeah, that was really good. I forgot about that. That was very fun.
Yeah, and then there are just lots of like those perspective moments that I mentioned before where the first big level you go through has a thing where Mio can run on walls, mm-hmm. like actually like flip her gravity kind of. And they do a couple things with that with just the look of it that is so incredibly effective that I just go, fuck, okay, that actually got me. I went from completely making fun of this game to going, yeah, you do know what looks cool and that does look cool.
Yeah, when they manage it, it's really pretty impressive. Agreed. Kind of moving into wrap up, I don't know that I have a whole lot more to say about it. The kind of central question I had when I got into this is how I feel about this game is complicated because it's the way that it's expressing itself thematically and writing wise. I don't just think is bad. Like a lot of games are bad in like a bland way. This feels offensively bad to me. This feels like the mind of a child. And it's about things I care about. Mm-hmm. You know, I care about art and I care about creativity. So it feels
and of course
a little
the
bit
power of friendship.
I do care about the power of friendship. I make fun of that because of anime shit, but like my friends are incredibly important to me. I don't have a family. You know, I don't have blood family. I have friend family. Actual relationships and that kind of closeness, incredibly important to me. This game pretending to it keeps me at a weird distance. Like I'm having fun with the play. I'm sometimes appreciating the play in novel ways that I don't often have when I'm playing a video game. And then at the same time, I'm like, yeah, but fuck this. That's what you're doing. Fuck you. Like this eye rolling that actually is interrupting my fun a little bit.
The thing is, you say pretending, but I think we touched on this before. I think that this is the best that Joseph Fares and then the people following his directives can do in terms of writing. I don't think they're being lazy. I think this is what they think good writing feels and sounds like.
And what I read about, this is wild, there are people for whom this really resonates. Even the writing. You can read accounts of people who are like, oh man, I cried my fucking eyes out at the end of Split Fiction. Like, I would do anything for these girls. This is a ride or die simulator for these two girls. And that is a deeply alienating feeling for me.
Yeah, I like I said, there are moments in this that work a little better for me than they did for you. Like I mentioned, there's that moment late in the game where you're in Zoe's subconscious and she is just destroyed. You've been eaten by the Hydra of grief, Gary, whose head you cannot cut off because it will always grow more.
Yeah, that's grief.
The fucking metaphors in this game.
And what is grief but Zoe, a Hydra persisting? And
what, Gary?
I said, what is grief but a Hydra persisting?
I'm so sorry I talked over that. Gwen, make it so I didn't talk over that because it was a good reference to a line I hate from a TV show.
And that's why I was doing it. I was getting a little guppy jab.
Yeah. And then you have this moment where, because in that level, Mio is like, she's themed around light for whatever fucking reason. But, and she is like, literally for that gameplay section, Zoe can't move out of the radius around Mio. So I can joke. It's a codependency simulator, which they also have another bit where they're tethered together. If they get too far apart from each other, they literally die.
Yeah,
that's earlier in the game. But I think that's actually, again, a moment where the play reinforces the theme. And I think when they do that and they're not talking, the game does cool, emotionally affecting things. But no, at the end of this, I was like, all I said at the end of this was like, God, I bet that book they wrote together sucks shit.
One of the worst books ever written. Like, yeah, my thesis here is those two things interface with each other. Like, at least for me, this idea, you don't have to have like perfectly realistic characters to have those bits where one character's friendship is the light that's protecting the other one from grief, which is a fine thing to do. But I do have to believe in them as people. And I do have to believe they have interior lives. I can't just see, you know, a note card with the word grief written on it and then have everything I associate with grief have that same weight.
Well, that's why we have to shoot you with the drug from the Invisibles that makes
thank you
literal World's concepts greatest dad. Become yeah
yeah one of my dad, that's my so favorite one of my favorite jokes in a comic ever. Everyone should read the Invisibles. The art gets real dodgy at the end. that's what it feels like it's doing to me. It's trying to make a symbolic representation of these big concepts without doing the work to actually. And I keep saying not doing the work. They think they are.
Yeah, they are doing their version of the work. It's just not very good.
Joseph Fares talked about how these two characters are based on his daughters. Horrible, right?
I take it all back. It's good. Everything. I like the characters. It's good. All right.
I'm just imagining being like growing to have an interior life, reading some books, learning about, you know, fiction, and then playing this game and being like, this is what fucking dad thought of me? Holy shit. You know? Whoa. It also made me think, the other thing that, and this is just journey to the center of the Gary shit that I'm always doing, is that other people are better at ignoring play or ignoring words than I am.
I was going to gently mention that.
Yes. I don't even necessarily think it's a weakness. It's just my approach to media. I don't ignore things that are part of the thing for me. Other people will be like, this game is super great. You just have to ignore all the dialogue. I can't do that. I'm not capable of doing it. I don't know how much of it has to do with the job because I'm like evaluating it, even when I'm not playing it for work. But it's very difficult for me to do that. So those things always talk to each other for me.
For me, even lacking that weakness that you clearly have, the fact that even if it's not dragging anything down for me, I don't feel much for these characters most of the time. I don't like them very much. And it a lot of what it's doing is reliant on me rooting for these people when really, I don't know, I kind of want the guy who made the holodeck to win a lot of the time.
I kind of wanted the second intern to win.
Is that the one who doesn't one of them ditch out earlier than the other?
Yeah. It's the one with the backbone, the lady.
Yeah.
There's a white lady and a black guy, and the white lady ditches out earlier. Make of that what you will.
That's
woke mob. That's basically what I mean. Like, even if you can ignore their writing and stuff.
Yeah. If you're not broken in the way Gary is.
If you're not broken the way I am, imagine how much stronger it'd be if you didn't have to.
Yeah, absolutely. If I actually liked Mio and Zoe, the end of this would hit so much harder.
Yeah, it would work. Like, it would actually work, as opposed to being a game that I finished and I was like, oh, that was really fun. God, I hate so much of what was said and thought about in that.
You excited for the movie, Gary?
No.
Yeah? It's got a newly controversial icon Sydney Sweeney attached to star.
Oh, hey.
Presumably is Zoe.
Oh, she's playing Zoe?
I mean, I would guess. There's only three characters in it, and Mio's not Sydney Sweeney coded.
No. I was trying to think of which one is more scantily clad. Here.
They're both in kind of skin tight stuff. Oh, there's a bit where they're feeling triumphant, so Zoe does a Sailor Moon transformation sequence. And I went like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, cute.
That's cute.
Cute reference. Any other final wrap-up thoughts on Split Fiction?
John M. Chu is directing that. Ooh, and the Deadpool and Wolverine writers are writing on it.
Oh, wow. Hmm. What else has that person directed?
He's done Wicked and Crazy Rich Asians.
I see. Okay. I'm not excited for the movie.
No. They announced it immediately after like the sales figures for the game started coming in.
Yes.
So
feels a little cynical to me. We'll see. They'll probably have to, you know what? It might end up being a little bit like the Ready Player One movie where like, because this has so many references and because it's doing genre stuff, like they'll probably have more direct pastiches.
Maybe it could be like Wreck-It Ralph where Bowser shows up.
Like Wreck-It Ralph. Be a good way to do it.
Yeah.
You know? So should you play this? You could play Wreck-It Ralph instead. Go to your local arcade. They might have the cabinet set up. It's okay.
It's fine. I don't think it's less good than Donkey Kong, which is what it's riffing on. So
it's way less good than Donkey Kong. I think this is worth playing if you have a co-op buddy.
That little digression probably sounds so insane to people who don't know they made a Wreck-It Ralph arcade cabinet.
They did. It's cute. It's cute that they made it.
It's cute. You'll play it once and then never again.
Yep. It's not very good. Weirdly too hard. Like Donkey Kong is not, you know, there's a challenging game that gets challenging as you go, but it has the grace to make the first level pretty easy.
Yeah.
You know, the Fix-It Felix game is just balls hard right out the gate.
And if you're in an arcade that has it, you're probably in an arcade that has Kicks. You could be playing Kicks instead.
Yeah. You could do it like you're probably in an arcade that has Donkey Kong and Donkey Kong Jr. Maybe Donkey Kong 3, which also I think is a pretty good game.
Or the Tron games. Tron games are pretty good.
Tron game is pretty good. Or some other good arcade games of the classic age.
This is kind of a Tron pastiche, Split Fiction.
There is like a Tron section. There's a part with more
neon. The whole game is Tron. You're sucked into the fiction. Verse.
You're sucked into the fiction. I just meant there's one of the sci-fi sections that have a little bit more neon than the others.
Didn't do like a light cycles thing.
Me too. They're saving it for Split Fiction too.
Gary, sci-fi stop versus it. Don't romance. Say that.
Okay.
Don't fucking say that. Don't. The secret is real and you're using it for bad.
What if the way it worked is they keep making sequels to this and whichever genre is better challenges a new genre in the new sequel?
Okay.
So like in the next one, we'd have light cycles because it'd be sci-fi, but it'd be against a different new genre.
So you do like think sci-fi is better than fantasy inarguably, and you've tipped your hand and revealed it.
I don't think that. I think you just said
that sci-fi wins.
No. I think that the perspective of the game is that it wins. It's paid so much more attention. Mio's story actually is very much focused in this. It feels more sci-fi focused.
Okay.
Also, the game itself is a sci-fi conceit.
Whoa. You know? Yeah. What if this just took place in a world of wizards and they were entering a cauldron?
Ooh, what if this took place? What if in Split Fiction 2, they go into the game Split Fiction, which itself is fiction?
I know. Gary, small chance that actually happens. I think genuinely in reality.
Yeah, I know. My Lady of Heaven is getting a workout today.
Yeah, because maybe in Split Fiction, they have not announced Split Fiction 2, but it made so much money. The only thing that will stop it from happening is Joseph Ferris genuinely having some of... He has an artistic point of view, and he has artistic pride. He's just a terrible writer.
Yeah.
That being said, they make a Split Fiction 2 where they've made a video game or a movie adaptation of Split Fiction 1, and you have to go back through it.
Yep.
Does seem like something they do.
It will depend on whether he gets greenlit to make Balls 2.
God, maybe this will get him back into the Ballsiverse.
I like him getting into the Ballsiverse. I would enjoy that. Oh, last thing. I forgot this is why Kay's better doing notes than I am.
Yeah, Gwen, go back and put this in where it's supposed to go.
You only had to buy one copy of this game.
Kicks ass. Such an amazing...
That kicks ass.
Hey, literally, I don't grade my reviews for work, but that's like a letter grade right there.
It's really smart. Because
Full crossplay.
Yeah. Full crossplay. You only have to buy one copy. It makes it the barrier to playing it not very high. And it makes it a good value, right? Like the half of this, like splitting this with a buddy, either as a gift or just you both pay for half of it, is about how much this should cost.
Yeah. I'm very philosophically, nervous about conversations about value in video games because I think it has really bad effects. But I do think what it does is there's no, if you want to pay, I think this was like $40 at launch. If you want to buy it for yourself, then there is no barrier of entry to get a friend to play with you.
Yeah. It's, I wish this was the model for co-op games.
Yeah. The way it works is they download a thing, a free thing. And then if they get an invite from a paid copy of the game, it feels like it's something from like 15 years ago of the internet where this was just like a thing that would happen.
Yeah. 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 It's uncommonly generous. And I think it's at least partially responsible for the really high sales. Will, where can people find you on the internet?
So if you want to hear me make stupid jokes with Gary, you can listen to Everything to Guppy here on Duckfeed. It comes out on Tuesday mornings. It is ostensibly a podcast about talking about everything in the video game, The Binding of Isaac. More often than not, it's a very stupid improv comedy show that uses Isaac concepts as prompts.
Mm-hmm.
We are currently, I think, two-thirds of the way through talking one episode, 1 hour at a time about every monster in the game.
It's a blitz.
We're blitzing through it.
You said it was ostensibly a Binding of Isaac. If you like that, you have to get in quick. Because it's going to pivot once we run out of Isaac content. We're on episode like 1,100 or something. And we are going to run out.
1,060, I think.
Yeah, we are going to run out of Isaac content soon. So hurry up.
If you would like to see me play video games, I stream at twitch.tv/plumberduck on Friday and Saturday nights at 8 p.m. Pacific. I am usually accompanied by my friend John, who I'm currently in the middle of replaying this game with. Lately we've been playing through Night Rain with the help of John's wife, Desiree. It's helped me find the fun in a game that aggressively didn't want me to find it. So that's nice. Mm-hmm. I'm also, if you want to read my professional writing, I am, William Hughes at the AV Club. I do my weekly game theory column. I also write a lot of news wires and anything else that people need help pitching in on. I have something like 12,000 bylines at the site. So if you click around enough, you'll see something by me.
Yeah, it's the only games writer who I read religiously.
Do you think you'd read my stuff if we weren't friends?
Yeah.
Liar.
No, I'm lying. Yeah, it's I'm habituated to it now. The AV Club is one of the places I look for games writing.
Okay, but you wouldn't have ever, I don't think you would have gotten habituated if not for the friendship.
I have no idea how to do the counterfactual for that. Well, so who knows? It would depend on what you were writing at the time. You know,
it's like if you be about detective games.
You've written about a lot of different stuff. If like I happened to find you when you were writing about something I was interested in, there's a good chance I would have been onboarded. Happen to be writing about like one of your 6 month stretches where they're very limp defenses of clickers, then I might not have been onboarded.
That is an incredibly uncharitable description of my work. I write about clickers like once a year, and it's just to check in on the constantly evolving and changing meta in the clicker game universe. Most of the time, it's about what a new detective game I played was.
That is true. It's oftentimes detective games recently. Yeah, but it goes through phases. I've been doing it for years, so you haven't been in the detective phase the entire time.
Yeah, I guess not. It is mostly, I guess, clicker games.
Yeah, I said that to hurt your feelings. This is a little preview of everything to Guppy for everybody.
And it would be, the polite thing for me to do is to have my feelings be hurt.
Yes, that's the tacit agreement we have with that. If you like this show, watch out for fireballs. We appreciate you listening to this. If you are kind of marginalized.
Is this a premium?
No, not a premium.
What the fuck?
I know, everyone gets
this. Make me premium, Gary.
Someday we'll do. We didn't do any guest episodes as premiums this first round because we're just experimenting with it.
Spread around the money.
We've got to spread around that money. If you want to give us that money, go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv. If you are a marginalized creator and you have any kind of project or product you'd like us to shout out, send me an email, gary@duckfeed.tv. Include your name, link, pronunciation, pronouns, anything I might need. We'd be happy to do so. If you have thoughts about Split Fiction, it is too late to write those in. I know. We'll be reading those thoughts on Split Fiction and Mercenaries and Metroid Zero in the Dispatch this month. But if you have thoughts about next month's games, aka largely Gary gets that month off, it's going to be about Outer Wilds, the Outer Eye or the Inside Eye, Echoes of the Eye, Majora's Mask, which is with Bob Mackie. I'm not on that episode. And then the premium episode for that month is Against the Storm, which I'm really excited about.
Storm is so fucking good.
Super excited. Join us in welcoming Bob for the show. That'll be fun. You can also leave us ratings, reviews on Apple Podcasts, Podcast Addict, and you can join us and thank you, our producer, Gwen.
Thank you, Gwen, for fixing the Colin Firth thing. Also, if people want to let Bob know it's been a while since he's had me on a Retronauts, you could maybe mention it.
Yeah, might be worth a shot. You got to find another game that he wants to talk about that only you have played.
No one else wants to talk
about. Yeah, those, you know, we're joking about that. I sincerely really like your episodes of Retronauts.
That's nice.
I do. It was great. The Final Fantasy, I like it because it allowed Retronauts to be negative a little bit.
Sure. Final Fantasy 16 is a game of contrasts.
Well, I mean, I think that Bob feels basically the same way you did about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was just nice to, because it feels like that show, I love that show, one of the first podcasts I ever got into, but it oftentimes, same. You know, if they don't have anything to say, anything nice to say, they don't say anything at all, it feels like. And the, like, some games ain't nice. Some games have mixed, have good and bads. So I like seeing that side of them. Yeah. Anything else?
No, I got, like, friends in town this weekend. I think we're going to do an escape room. Later. They're out at like the fancy Portland bakery where you can get like ube lava cheesecake right now. So I might get a bite of that later.
Nice. Until next time, what should they watch out for, Will?
Ube lava cheesecake, I think.
Yeah.
So fucking good, man.